Session number 10599, reel 17.
Major English, Reel 17. When you first came back to the battalion, Major, were you able to sense in any way the attitude of the battalion to making an assault into a very strong fortress after years of quite severe fighting in other theatres?
Yes, I think the prevailing mood really was that if the war was going to be brought to a successful conclusion, well, the job had to be done. But there's no doubt that many thought, rather fewer expressed it, but many thought that, well, really, we've done our whack, and it should be left to the others who spent the war in England. And I think that this was quite a relevant problem. It was overcome, as we'll relate, really, when they realized the tremendous organization and support they were going to get. And there was problems of morale and a certain amount of indiscipline. A small amount, I should say, really, of indiscipline in respect of people being absent without, soldiers being absent without leave. Now, there were a number of these, I suppose, in the battalion, they'd never got beyond about a dozen or about 20. But I remember us being struck by the fact that when it became obvious to everybody that the time was nearby, and we were being sealed into camps and that sort of thing, that every one of them came back in time. In fact, one chap is reputed to have said to the provost sergeant, "Well, I'm off, but I'll be back in time." And they did that, but they just wanted a few more days at home.
Yes, would you say that the attitude was that they're so close to their families after being away for so long that they wanted to see more of them?
That's right. I mean, they'd all had a period of embarkation leave, and I think there may have been, although I wasn't at the battalion at the time, but there may have been some other leave as well. And the question of leave was taken very seriously. But one or two said, "Right, well, I just want to have a few more days at home," and off they went, without any leave, without permission. But
how,
as I say,
how were you welcomed back to the battalion?
Well, very well, really, particularly on those who knew me, because there were quite a number who didn't. And particularly, I was pleased to be welcomed back by some of the other ranks who'd been with me. For instance, my signal lance, Corporal Simpson, and some of the NCOs, which is very pleasing.
So you're thrust back with the battalion, and now the training is for Europe.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, there had been, while I'm in Suffolk, pretty intensive training program directed at handling weapons and exercises of all units and subunits, and also a certain amount of amphibious training. There's one thing that was new as far as I was concerned, and as we now had been issued with what was known as a 38 set, which was communication between the company headquarters and platoons. And that was something that I had to get to know. Another thing that we were faced with very soon after I got back. As it was decided that one company in every infantry battalion, at least those in the landing divisions, should be issued with bicycles for a quick and temporary mobile force. And D Company was chosen as the cycle-borne company. And these were airborne cycles. I'm not quite certain who designed them, but they're more like a sort of medieval instrument of torture, really, than anything else. They were really the most awful things, but I dare say they did their job. So we had to get used to these and ride them, and not only ride them, but ride them with all our kit and carrying rifles and all that. And so we did a certain amount of, the company did a few exercises with these cycles.
How did you disperse your equipment whilst riding a cycle? How did you?
Well, there was a bracket on it to actually carry the rifle. But I mean, otherwise you just wore your equipment like you would normally. I mean, a small pack and all that sort of thing. I think the problem was the signalers and those people and Bren gunners, and they rigged up some contraption to hold the Bren gun, but they really weren't very easy because they were designed for airborne people who were largely light automatics, really. I mean, submachine guns and this sort of thing. Anyway, I think we more or less got used to them. early in May, we had an amphibious exercise called Fabius. And this was meant to be the dress rehearsal for the marrying up with the landing craft and so on. And we went down, taken down to Southampton, where we went on board the LCIs, that's a landing craft infantry. And they held about 240 men, in other words, two companies. And the battalion were allotted three, and they were all manned by Americans, American crews. And we lived there on them for 3 days, and we got used to the Americans, and they got used to us. We got to know them, and we went off the ships during the day and did route marches and that sort of thing. And and then when the exercise proper started, we went out to sea and landed on Hayling Island. And this was to practice the business of landing and also practice the beach groups, which were in charge of the beaches, of course. And for the first time, the soldiers were issued with waterproof leggings, waterproof waders, really, which came up to their waist. And we thought this was a good thing, although it was rather awkward to march in. But as soon as we got off the beach, because we discarded them, but they thought that we really ought to have them. You couldn't have chaps getting their trousers wet. So that that was really the last exercise we did. Soon after that, the F echelon, as it was called, that was the fighting part of the battalion, rifle companies and support company, battalion headquarters, moved to another camp in Nightingale Wood. Were very well named. There were a number of nightingales singing it, which was an absolute glory. Lovely old oak wood. And we did intensive training from there also. A lot of field firing. I remember having tremendous problems with on the lowland heath there in Dorset, being very dry, and starting off a number of forest fires, which were very rather bad, and when the exercise had to come to a halt while we put these out, particularly with, I mean, we couldn't use mortar smoke, for instance, that sort of thing. And of course the quartermaster staff were extremely busy ensuring that we all had everything that we should have had, and that they were all fully equipped, and there were constant checks to see that this was so. Nevertheless, we did manage to take time off as well, and there were a number of dances organised, and we had a camp cinema with fairly frequent changes of the programme. The camps were run, in some cases they were run by Americans, but in our case they were run by British who had, from units, who had been seconded particularly to that job. I mean, they may well have followed up in and been reinforcements later on, but they were taken off their normal work to run these camps.
Were they tented camps, Major?
Tented, yes. Yep. and we ran the CO ran a drill competition, which I think was a useful corrective to all the sort of just to smarten everybody up for a bit. And also a battalion sports meeting. I was pleased that D Company won the drill competition and also won the sports. And then on the 13th of May, we had a visit from General Eisenhower. And he, as was the custom, got everybody... He inspected the battalion first and then got everybody sitting round. And I think we were all very impressed with him. Imparted a tremendous lot of confidence and spoke very well.
Do you recall anything that he said that day?
Well, he said that this was a crucial operation. On the one hand, it would be, if successful, the end of the war would be in the near future. If unsuccessful, it would be set back for years. And also emphasized, although he could give no details at that stage, of the tremendous support. And in many cases, the preparation was already going on from the Air Force. And that the other thing he emphasized was the question of teamwork. And of course, he was extremely good at this. I mean, he had his joint headquarters of British and Americans, and anyone that took a nationalistic attitude, he dismissed them, he sent them away. And he said that this is, you'll be fighting alongside Americans, and they'll be fighting alongside you, and it's all one big team. I remember that very well. Well then, as far as the planning was concerned on a battalion level, the orderly room, in other words, the battalion headquarters orderly room, was converted into a planning office. And the security was extremely strict. No one was allowed in without permission from somebody inside. And it was open really only to the CO and the second in command and the adjutant and the intelligence officer. And the intelligence officer was beginning, he was busy making models of the beaches and so on. Now in the last week of May, all camps were sealed and no one was allowed in or out without a special pass. And then the next day we were, that was company commanders, rifle company commanders, and specialist platoon commanders were taken to brigade headquarters for a brigade briefing. And there in front of us was a model of the beaches and the immediate hinterland. but was no proper names. And the brigade intelligence officer told us all he knew about the enemy and who was manning the beaches and the type of obstacles and all this sort of thing. And the brigadier explained the general army plan and also the, in some detail, the fire plan for the whole operation. And I think when we heard this, everyone was really absolutely amazed, and you know, morale went up quite a bit, because the volume of fire, both from naval and aircraft, and then later on from our own artillery, was really stupendous. The divisional plan, the 50th Division was one of the right hand of three British infantry divisions, landed on Gold Beach. And the leading brigades were 231 Brigade on the right and 69 Brigade on the left. And then coming in behind them was 151 Brigade on the left and 56 Brigade, which had been attached to 50th Division, or under command of 50th Division for the operation. And they also had under command the 8th Armoured Brigade. So in fact it was the strongest division on D-Day by quite a margin. And the the landing was to be between La Riviere and Arromanches. Well, as far as the brigadier then gave out his part of the plan, and 60 DLI were to be the right forward, 9 DLI left, with 8 DLI in reserve. So from our point of view in the 8th, we were the reserve battalion of a follow-up brigade, which I suppose was one of the easier jobs as far as D-Day was concerned. Now another startling piece of information which we were given was the details of the Mulberry Harbour and how we were all going to be supplied. And all the work had been going on about that. Well, in the next few days, all the men were briefed, and each company came in turn to see the battalion model and our particular beach. And again, of course, there were no proper place names. And they, when they heard the details of the fire plan, I think everyone thought, well, this is a party that might be well worth going on. The support was going to be absolutely tremendous. And we were also issued with air photos, not only verticals, but obliques, which gave a picture of the beach as we would see it from sea level, and they were going to be very useful. On the 3rd of June, we were told to get ready, and life jackets were issued, and also seasick pills. I don't know whether they had them in Sicily or not, but I think it was the first time I'd come across being issued with seasick pills. And we also issued these waders and emergency rations and Tommy cookers, just for the operation, really, on the basis of the one per section. As we went, we debussed down on in the Southampton port area, and as we were marching from the trucks to the LCIs, just on the quayside there, we saw Churchill and Eden and General Smuts and Ernest Bevin. And they They didn't say anything to us, but they took a close interest. On June the 4th, that was the day after we'd got on the ships, we were told that there was going to be a 24-hour postponement. And I was asked by Colonel Lidwell, as there was going to be a day of rather sort of hanging about. I should add at this point that on the quay, a sort of rest area had been made in a big shed, and that people could buy drinks and coffee and so on, and easy chairs and this sort of thing. Anyway, Colonel Little asked me, he said, in view of the fact that we've got a spare day, would I mind giving a talk to the battalion about my Italian walk? So that was done, and drew a bit of a map and so on, and that was really, from my point of view anyway, I dare say, quite interesting. I think some of the people remembered a bit of it. I met a soldier the other day who said, I remember your talk at Southampton about Italy. Anyway, at 8:30, I think, in the evening of the 5th of June, we cast off and slipped silently, really, without any noise at all, out of away from the quay and down Southampton Water.
Before we go any further, Major, into the actual invasion, could you tell me the composition of your company and
yes,
officers
we
and NCOs that you had with you?
Yes, we had a normal rifle company establishment of three platoons, each of 32 men, each of three sections. The second in command was Jimmy Califer, who had been commanding up to the time I got back. This was 16, 17 and 18 platoons. 16 platoon was commanded by Lieutenant Lawn, who had not been with us very long, I think. 17 platoon was commanded by Lieutenant England, who was also inexperienced. And 18 platoon was commanded by Ernie Cousins, who had certainly been in Sicily, and who came, I think, to the battalion after Marath, and was a very good platoon commander. And we had a number of NCOs who'd been with the battalion in the desert and earlier, and the several new ones who seemed well trained and fairly good chaps. I had a company sergeant major was a man called Brown, who'd been in England all the time and who'd volunteered to be transferred from the 14th battalion to a battalion that was going to Normandy, and he was a great standby. Shall I carry on? as I say, we left on the evening of the 5th of June, and the first job we had when we got to sea and we got into our formation was to read out orders of the day, and these came from General Eisenhower first and General Montgomery, and also from our division commander, General Graham. And then we were told to open up the maps. These had been in sealed containers, and we issued these maps down to platoon sergeant. And of course, we all knew where we were going at that point. Then I think soldiers tried to get some sleep, and I remember having a few hours. The journey was pretty uneventful. There was a bit of a swell at that time, which of course gradually got worse, and by dawn it was pretty rough, and many people were feeling far from well. I don't know, some people had breakfast. I think perhaps the majority did, but I know some certainly didn't. They didn't, the last thing they wanted. And in spite of the pills, really, the seasick pills, which everyone had taken, we didn't feel at all well. I know I was pretty groggy. But, of course, in the event, we realised that this has helped, because it heightened the surprise. I think the Germans, one reads now, thought that an invasion in those weather conditions would be impossible. But, I mean, some, one or two, I know, in my company, just couldn't get up at all and had to be carried ashore. You know, they were so ill.
Is this a good time to ask what your immediate role was as a company when you got to the beach?
Our immediate role, if everything had gone right beforehand, was to collect together, move off the beach, or rather I should say move off the beach as rapidly as possible, collect together, and then move to the battalion assembly area. Obviously we didn't know at that stage what in fact we would have to do, but that was those were the orders. Now, I think on Gold Beach, the HR was 25 minutes past 7 on the 6th of June. But we didn't, in fact, expect to land till about 11. When it got light, there were two impressions, really, we had. The first was the fantastic number of ships that were all around, both large and small. Every sort of landing craft and every sort of naval craft, including the most enormous battleships, who were engaged in firing at targets inland, and of course the air working above us. It was a very cold and cloudy day. It was a bit of a drizzle, but the impression of all this, these ships, was really absolutely amazing. And the other was that how easy it was and how valuable they were to line up with the air photos. And we looked at had the air photos in front of us, and we looked at the ground in front of us and said, oh yes, well that's that house there at La Riviere. And we knew that we were being landed at exactly the right place, which of course had not happened in Sicily. And as we began to approach, the beach looked pretty quiet, which was heartening, because it meant that the assault wave had done their job, and there wasn't going to be much fighting at that time anyway. Now at about 11 we got the order came to get dressed and of course get these waders on, and the two other LCIs went in and landed their troops with A and B Company in battalion headquarters.